Wolf Hall, Disc 7.
Isha, 2 days later. He's hardly through the gateway when Cavendish comes hurtling across the courtyard. Master Cromwell, yesterday the king... Calmly, George, he advises. Yesterday, he sent us 4 cartloads of furnishings. Come and see. Tapestry, plate, bed hangings. Was it by your suit? Who knows? He hadn't asked for anything directly. If he had, he'd have been more specific. Not that hanging, but this hanging, which my lord likes. He likes goddesses, rather than virgin martyrs. So away with St. Agnes, and let's have Venus in a grove. My lord likes Venetian glassware. Take away these battered silver goblets. He looks contemptuous as he inspects the new stuff. Only the best for you boys from Putney, Wolsey says. It is possible, he adds, almost apologising, that what the king appointed for me was not in fact what was sent, that inferior substitutions were made by inferior persons. That is entirely possible, he says. Still, even so, we are more comfortable for it. The difficulty is, Cavendish says, we need to move. This whole house needs to be scrubbed out and aired. True, the cardinal says. St. Agnes, bless her, would be knocked over by the smell of the privies. So will you make suit to the king's council? He sighs. George, what is the point? Listen, I'm not talking to Thomas Howard. I'm not talking to Brandon. I'm talking to him. The cardinal smiles. A fat, paternal beam. He is surprised, as they thrash out a financial settlement for the cardinal, at Henry's grasp of detail. Wolsey has always said that the king has a fine mind, as quick as his father's, but more comprehensive. The old king grew narrow as he aged. He kept a hard hand on England. There was no nobleman he did not hold by a debt or bond, and he said frankly that if he could not be loved, he would be feared. Henry has a different nature, but what is it? Wolsey laughs and says, I should write you a handbook. But as he walks in the gardens of the little lodge at Richmond, where the king has allowed him to remove, the cardinal's mind becomes clouded. He talks about prophecies and about the downfall of the priests of England, which he says is foretold and will now happen. Even if you don't believe in omens, and he doesn't personally, he can see the problem. For if the cardinal is guilty of a crime in asserting his jurisdiction as legate, are not all those clerics from bishops downwards who assented to his legacy also guilty? He can't be the only person who's thinking about this. But mostly his enemies can't see past the cardinal himself, his vast scarlet presence on the horizon. They fear it will loom up again, ready for revenge. These are bad times for proud prelates, says Brandon, when next they meet. He sounds jaunty, a man whistling to keep his courage up. We need no cardinals in this realm. And he, the cardinal says, furious, he, Brandon, when he married the king's sister out of hand, when he married her in the first days of her widowhood, knowing the king intended her for another monarch, his head would have been parted from his body if I, a simple cardinal, had not pleaded for him to the king. I, a simple cardinal. And what excuse did Brandon make? The cardinal says. Oh, your majesty, your sister Mary cried. How she did cry and beg me to marry her myself. I never saw a woman cry so. So he dried her tears and got himself up to a dukedom. And now he talks as if he's held his title since the Garden of Eden. Listen, Thomas, if men of sound learning and good disposition come to me, as Bishop Tunstall comes, as Thomas More comes, and plead that the church must be reformed, why then I listen. But Brandon, to talk about proud prelates? What was he? The king's horsekeeper. And I've known horses with more wit. My lord, Cavendish pleads, be more temperate, and Charles Brandon, you know, was of an ancient family, a gentleman born. Gentleman he? A swaggering braggart, that's Brandon. The Cardinal sits down, exhausted. My headaches, he says. Cromwell, go to court and bring me better news. Day by day, he takes his instructions from Wolsey at Richmond and rides to wherever the king is. He thinks of the king as a terrain into which he must advance with no sea coast to supply him. He understands what Henry has learned from his cardinal, his floating diplomacy, his science of ambiguity. He sees how the king has applied this science to the slow, trackless, dubious ruin of his minister. Every kindness, Henry matches with a cruelty, some further charge or forfeiture, till the cardinal moans, I want to go away. Winchester, he suggests to the dukes. My lord cardinal is willing to proceed to his palace there. What, so near the king? Brandon says. We are not fools to ourselves, Master Cromwell. Since he, the cardinal's man, is with Henry so often, rumours have run all over Europe that Wolsey is about to be recalled. The king is cutting a deal, people say, to have the church's wealth in exchange for Wolsey's return to favour. Rumours leak from the council chamber, from the privy chamber. The king does not like his new setup. Norfolk is found ignorant. Suffolk is accused of having an annoying laugh. He says, My lord won't go north. He's not ready for it. But I want him north, Howard says. Tell him to go. Tell him Norfolk says he must be on the road and out of here. Or, and tell him this, I will come where he is and I will tear him with my teeth. My lord, he bows. May I substitute the word bite? Norfolk approaches him. He stands far too close. His eyes are bloodshot. Every sinew is jumping. He says, Substitute nothing, you misbegotten. The Duke stabs a forefinger into his shoulder. You person, he says, and again, You nobody from hell. You horse-born, you cluster of evil, you lawyer. He stands there, pushing away like a baker pressing the dimples into a batch of manchet loaves. Cromwell's flesh is firm, dense, and impermeable. The ducal finger just bounces off. Before they left Esher, one of the cats that had been brought in to kill the vermin gave birth to a litter in the cardinal's own rooms. What presumption in an animal. But wait, new life in the cardinal's suite. Could that be an omen? One day he fears there will be an omen of another sort. A dead bird will fall down that smoking chimney and then, oh, woe is us. He'll never hear the last of it. But for the while the cardinal is amused and puts the kittens on a cushion in an open chest, and watches as they grow. One of them is black and hungry, with a coat like wool and yellow eyes. When it is weaned, he brings it home. He takes it from under his coat, where it has been sleeping, curled against his shoulder. Gregory, look. He holds it out to his son. I am a giant. My name is Marlinspike. Gregory looks at him, wary, puzzled. His glance flinches. His hand pulls away. The dogs will kill it, he says. Marlinspike goes down to the kitchen to grow stout and live out his beastly nature. There is a summer ahead, though he cannot imagine its pleasures. Sometimes when he's walking in the garden, he sees him, a half-grown cat, lolling watchful in an apple tree or snoring on a wall in the sun. Spring 1530. Antonio Bonvisi, the merchant, invites him to supper at his fine tall house on Bishopsgate. I won't be late, he tells Richard, expecting that it will be the usual tense gathering, everyone cross and hungry, for even a rich Italian with an ingenious kitchen cannot find 100 ways with smoked eel or salt cod. The merchants in Lent miss their mutton and malmsey, their nightly grunt in a feather bed with wife or mistress. From now till Ash Wednesday, their knives will be out for some cutthroat intelligence, some mean commercial advantage. But it is a grander occasion than he thought. The Lord Chancellor is there, amongst a company of lawyers and aldermen. Humphrey Monmouth, whom Moore once locked up, is seated well away from the great man. Moore looks at his ease, holding the company captive with one of his stories about that great scholar Erasmus, his dear friend. But when he looks up and sees him, Cromwell, he falls silent halfway through a sentence. He casts his eyes down, and an opaque and stony look grows on his face. "Did you want to talk about me?" he asks. "You can do it while I'm here, Lord Chancellor. I have a thick skin." He knocks back a glass of wine and laughs. "Do you know what Brandon is saying? He can't fit my life together, my travels. The other day he called me a Jewish peddler."
"And was that to your face?"
his host asks politely.
"No, the king told me. But then my Lord Cardinal calls Brandon a horsekeeper."
Humphrey Monmouth says,
"You have the entree these days, Thomas. What do you think now you are a courtier?"
There are smiles around the table, because, of course, the idea is so ridiculous, the situation so temporary. Moore's people are city people, no grander. But he is sui generis, a scholar and a wit. And Moore says,
"Perhaps we should not press the point. There are delicate issues here. There is a time to be silent."
An elder of the Draper's Guild leans across the table and warns, his voice low,
"Thomas Moore said, when he took his seat, that he won't discuss the Cardinal or the lady either."
He, Cromwell, looks around at the company. "The King surprises me, though, what he will tolerate."
"From you," Moore says.
"I mean Brandon. They're going to hunt." He walks in and shouts, "Are you ready?"
"Your master, the Cardinal, found it a constant battle,"
Bonvisi says,
"in the early years of the reign, to stop the king's companions becoming too familiar with him."
"He wanted only himself to be familiar," Moore suggests.
"Though, of course, the king may raise up whom he will."
"Up to a point, Thomas," Bonvisi says.
There is some laughter.
"And the king enjoys his friendships. That is good, surely."
"A soft word from you, Master Cromwell."
"Not at all," Monmouth says.
"Master Cromwell is known as one who does everything for his friends."
"I think," Moore stops.
He looks down at the table.
"In all truth, I'm not sure if one can regard a prince as a friend."
"But surely," Bonvisi says, "you've known Henry since he was a child."
"Yes, but friendship should be less exhausting. It should be restorative, not like..."
Moore turns to him, for the first time, as if inviting comment.
"I sometimes feel it is like Jacob wrestling with the angel."
"And who knows," he says, "what that fight was about?"
"Yes. The text is silent, as with Cain and Abel, who knows?"
He senses a little disquiet around the table, among the more pious, the less sportive, or just those keen for the next course. What will it be? Fish!
"When you speak to Henry," Moore says, "I beg you, speak to the good heart, not the strong will."
He would pursue it, but the aged draper waves for more wine and asks him,
"How's your friend Stephen Vaughan? What's new in Antwerp?"
The conversation is about trade then. It is about shipping, interest rates. It's no more than a background hum to unruly speculation. If you come into a room and say, "This is what we're not talking about," it follows that you're talking about nothing else. If the Lord Chancellor weren't here, it would be just import duties and bonded warehouses.
We would not be thinking of the brooding Scarlet Cardinal, and our starved Lenten minds would not be occupied by the image of the King's fingers creeping over a resistant, quick-breathing and virginal bosom. He leans back and fixes his gaze on Thomas More. In time, there is a natural pause in conversation, a lull. And after a quarter hour, in which he has not spoken, the Lord Chancellor breaks into it, his voice low and angry, his eyes on the remnants of what he has eaten. "The Cardinal of York," he says, "has agreed that it will never be appeased for ruling over other men."
"Lord Chancellor," Bonvisi says, "you are looking at your herring as if you hate it."
Says the gracious guest, "There's nothing wrong with the herring." He leans forward, ready for this fight. He means not to let it pass. The Cardinal is a public man. So are you. Should he shrink from a public role?
Yes. Moore looks up. Yes, I think a little he should. A little less evident appetite, perhaps.
It's late, Monmouth says, to read the Cardinal a lesson in humility.
His real friends have read it long ago and been ignored.
And you count yourself his friend. He sits back, arms folded. I'll tell him, Lord Chancellor, and by the blood of Christ, he will find it a consolation, as he sits in exile and wonders why you have slandered him to the king.
Gentlemen!
Bonvisi rises in his chair, edgy.
No, he says. Sit down. Let's have this straight. Thomas More, here, will tell you. I would have been a simple monk, but my father put me to the law. I would spend my life in church if I had the choice. I am, as you know, indifferent to wealth. I am devoted to things of the spirit. The world's esteem is nothing to me. He looks around the table. So how did he become Lord Chancellor? Was it an accident?
The doors open. Bonvisi jumps to his feet. Relief floods his face.
Welcome, welcome, he says. Gentlemen, the Emperor's ambassador.
It is Eustache Chapuis. Come in with the desserts. The new ambassador, as one calls him, though he has been in post since fall. He stands poised on the threshold, so they may know him and admire. A little crooked man, in a doublet slashed and puffed, blue satin billowing through black. Beneath it, his little black spindly legs.
I regret to be so late, he says.
He simpers.
Les dépêches, toujours les dépêches.
That's the ambassador's life. He looks up and smiles. Thomas Cromwell.
Ah, c'est le juif errant.
At once the ambassador apologizes, while smiling around as if bemused at the success of his joke. Sit down, says Bonvisi. And the servants bustle, the cloths are swept away, the company rearranges itself more informally, except for the Lord Chancellor, who goes on sitting where he's sitting. Preserved autumn fruits come in, and spiced wine, and Chapuis takes a place of honour beside Moore.
We will speak French, gentlemen, says Bonvisi.
French, as it happens, is the first language of the ambassador of the Empire and Spain. And like any other diplomat, he will never take the trouble to learn English, for how will that help him in his next posting? So kind, he says, as he eases himself back in the carved chair the host has vacated. His feet do not quite touch the floor. Moore rouses himself then. He and the ambassador put their heads together. He watches them. They glance back at him resentfully, but looking is free. In a tiny moment when they pause, he cuts in.
Monsieur Chapuis, you know, I was talking with the king recently about those events, so regrettable, when your master's troops plundered the holy city. Perhaps you can advise us. We don't understand them even now.
Chapuis shakes his head.
Most regrettable events.
Thomas More thinks it was the secret Mohammedans in your army who ran wild. Oh, and my own people, of course, the Wandering Jews. But before this, he said it was the Germans, the Lutherans, who raped the poor virgins and desecrated the shrines. In all cases, as the Lord Chancellor says, the Emperor must blame himself. But to whom should we attach blame? Are you able to help us out?
My dear Sir Chancellor.
The ambassador is shocked. His eyes turn towards Thomas More.
Did you speak so of my imperial master?
A glance flicked over his shoulder, and he drops into Latin. The company, linguistically agile, sit and smile at him. He advises pleasantly, if you wish to be half-secret, try Greek.
Allez, Monsieur Chapuis,
rattle away. The Lord Chancellor will understand you. The party breaks up soon after, the Lord Chancellor rising to go. But before he does, he makes a pronouncement to the company in English.
Master Cromwell's position is indefensible, it seems to me. He is no friend to the church, as we all know, but he is friend to one priest, and that priest the most corrupt in Christendom.
With the curtest of nods, he takes his leave. Even Chapuis does not warrant more. The ambassador looks after him, dubious, biting his lip, as if to say, I looked for more help and friendship there. Everything Chapuis does, he notices, is like something an actor does. When he thinks, he casts his eyes down, places two fingers to his forehead. When he sorrows, he sighs. When he is perplexed, he wags his chin, he half smiles. He is like a man who has wandered inadvertently into a play, who has found it to be a comedy, and decided to stay and see it through. The supper is over. The company dwindle away into the early dusk. Perhaps sooner than he would have liked, he says to Bonvisi.
Thomas More is my old friend. You should not come here and bait him.
Oh, have I spoiled your party? You invited Monmouth? Was that not to bait him?
No, Humphrey Monmouth is my friend too.
And I?
Of course.
They have slid back naturally into Italian. Tell me something that intrigues me, he says. I want to know about Thomas Wyatt. Wyatt went to Italy having attached himself to a diplomatic mission, rather suddenly, 3 years ago now. He had a disastrous time there, but that's for another evening. The question is, why did he run away from the English court in such haste?
Ah, Guyette and Lady Anne, Bonvisi says. An old story, I'd have thought.
Well, perhaps, he says. But he tells him about the boy Mark, the musician, who seems sure Wyatt's had her. If the story's bouncing around Europe among servants and menials, what are the odds the king hasn't heard?
A part of the art of ruling, I suppose, is to know when to shut your ears.
And Guyette is handsome, Bonvisi says.
In the English style, of course. He's tall, he's blonde. My countrymen marvel at him. Where do you breed such people? And so is Shuret, of course.
And a poet.
He laughs at his friend because, like all the Italians, he can't say Wyatt. It comes out Guyette, or something like that. There was a man called Hawkwood, a knight of Essex, used to rape and burn and murder in Italy in the days of chivalry. The Italians called him Acuto, the needle. Yes, but Anne, he senses from his glimpses of her that she is unlikely to be moved by anything so impermanent as beauty. These few years she has needed a husband more than anything, a name, an establishment, a place from which she can stand and negotiate with the king. Now Wyatt's married. What could he offer her?
Verses, says the merchant. It wasn't diplomacy took him out of England. It was that she was torturing him. He no longer dared to be in the same room with her, the same castle, the same country.
He shakes his head.
Aren't the English odd?
Christ, aren't they? He says.
You must take care. The lady's family, they are pushing a little against the limit of what can be done. They are saying, why wait for the Pope? Can we not make a marriage contract without him?
It would seem to be the way forward.
Try one of these sugar almonds.
He smiles.
Bonvisi says, Tommaso, I may give you some advice. The cardinal is finished.
Don't be so sure.
Yes, and if you did not love him, you would know it was true.
The cardinal has been nothing but good to me.
But he must go north.
The world will chase him. You ask the ambassadors. Ask Chapuis. Ask them who they report to. We have them at Isha, at Richmond.
Toujours les dépêches.
That's us.
But that is what he's accused of, running a country within the country.
He sighs. I know.
But what will you do about it?
Ask him to be more humble. Bonvisi laughs.
Ah, Thomas, please. You know when he goes north, you will be a man without a master. That is the point. You are seeing the king. But it is only for now, while he works out how to give the cardinal a payoff that will keep him quiet. But then...
He hesitates. The king likes me.
The king is an inconstant lover.
Not to Anne.
That is where I must warn you. Oh, not because of Guyet, not because of any gossip, any light thing said, but because it must all end soon. She will give away. She is just a woman. Think how foolish a man would have been if he had linked his fortunes to those of the lady's sister who came before her.
Yes, just think. He looks around the room. That's where the Lord Chancellor sat. On his left, the hungry merchants. On his right, the new ambassador. There, Humphrey Monmouth the heretic. There, Antonio Bonvisi. Here, Thomas Cromwell. And there are ghostly places set for the Duke of Suffolk, large and bland. For Norfolk, jangling his holy medals and shouting, "By the Mass!" There is a place set for the king, and for the doughty little queen, famished in this penitential season, her belly quaking inside the stout armour of her robes. There was a place set for Lady Anne, glancing around with her restless black eyes, eating nothing, missing nothing, tugging at the pearls around her little neck. There was a place for William Tyndale, and one for the Pope. Clement looks at the candid quinces, too coarsely cut, and his Medici lip curls. And there sits Brother Martin Luther, greasy and fat, glowering at them all and spitting out his fish bones. A servant comes in.
Two young gentlemen are outside, Master, asking for you by name.
He looks up. Yes?
Master Richard Cromwell and Master Rafe, with servants from your household waiting to take you home.
He understands that the whole purpose of the evening has been to warn him, off. He will remember it, the fatal placement, if it proves fatal. That soft hiss and whisper of stone destroying itself, the distant sound of walls sliding, of plaster crumbling, of rubble crashing onto fragile human skulls, that is the sound of the roof of Christendom falling on the people below. Bonvisi says,
"You have a private army, Tommaso. I suppose you have to watch your back."
"You know I do." His glance sweeps the room, one last look. "Good night. It was a good supper. I liked the eels. Will you send your cook to see mine? I have a new sauce to brighten the season. One needs mace and ginger, some dried mint leaves chopped." His friend says,
"I beg of you, I implore you to be careful.
A little, but a very little garlic.
Wherever you dine next, pray do not.
And of breadcrumbs a scant handful.
Sit down with the Boleyns."
Chapter 2. Entirely Beloved Cromwell. Spring to December 1530. He arrives early at York Place. The baited gulls, penned in their keeping yards, are crying out to their free brothers on the river, who wheel screaming and diving over the palace walls. The carmen are pushing up from the river, goods incoming, and the court smell of baking bread. Some children are bringing fresh rushes, tied in bundles, and they greet him by name. For their civility, he gives each of them a coin, and they stop to talk.
"So, you're going to the evil lady? She has bewitched the king, you know. Do you have a medal or a relic, master, to protect you?"
"I had a medal, but I lost it."
"You should ask our cardinal," one child says. "He will give you another."
The scent of the rushes is sharp and green. The morning is fine. The rooms of York Place are familiar to him, and as he passes through them towards the inner chambers, he sees a half-familiar face and says, "Mark." The boy detaches himself from the wall where he's leaning. "You're about early. How are you?" A sulky shrug. "It must feel strange to be back here at York Place. Now the world is so altered." "No." "You don't miss my Lord Cardinal?" "No." "You are happy?" "Yes." "My Lord will be pleased to know." To himself, he says as he moves away, "You may never think of us, Mark, but we think of you. Or at least I do. I think of you calling me a felon and predicting my death. It is true that the Cardinal always says, there are no safe places, there are no sealed rooms. You may as well stand on Cheapside shouting out your sins as confess to a priest anywhere in England. But when I spoke to the Cardinal of Killing, when I saw a shadow on the wall, there was no one to hear. So if Mark reckons I'm a murderer, that's only because he thinks I look like one." 8 anterooms. In the last, where the Cardinal should be, he finds Anne Boleyn. "Look, there are Solomon and Sheba, unrolled again, back on the wall. There is a draught. Sheba eddies towards him, rosy, round, and he acknowledges her. Anselma, lady made of wool, I thought I'd never see you again." He had sent word back to Antwerp, applied discreetly for news. Anselma was married, Stephen Vaughan said, and to a younger man, a banker. "So if he drowns or anything," he said, "let me know." Vaughan writes back, "Thomas, come now. Isn't England full of widows and fresh young girls?" Sheba makes Anne look bad, sallow and sharp. She stands by the window, her fingers tugging and ripping at a sprig of rosemary. When she sees him, she drops it, and her hands dip back into her trailing sleeves. In December, the king gave a banquet to celebrate her father's elevation to be Earl of Wiltshire. The queen was elsewhere, and Anne sat where Catherine should sit. There was frost on the ground, frost in the atmosphere. They only heard of it in the Wolsey household. The Duchess of Norfolk, who is always furious about something, was furious that her niece should have precedence. The Duchess of Suffolk, Henry's sister, refused to eat. Neither of these great ladies spoke to Boleyn's daughter. Nevertheless, Anne had taken her place as the first lady of the kingdom. But now it's the end of Lent, and Henry has gone back to his wife. He hasn't the face to be with his concubine as we move towards the week of Christ's Passion. Her father is abroad on diplomatic business. So is her brother, George, now Lord Rochford. So is Thomas Wyatt, the poet whom she tortures. She's alone and bored at York Place, and she's reduced to sending for Thomas Cromwell to see if he offers any amusement. A flurry of little dogs, 3 of them, run away from her skirts, yapping, darting towards him. "Don't let them out," Anne says. And with practiced and gentle hands, he scoops them up. They are the kind of dogs, bellers,
with ragged ears and tiny wafting tails, that any merchant's wife would keep across the narrow sea. By the time he has given them back to her, they have nibbled his fingers and his coat, licked his face, and yearned towards him with goggling eyes, as if he were someone they had so much longed to meet. Two of them he sets gently on the floor, the smallest he hands back to Anne. "Vous êtes gentille," she says, "and how my babies like you. I could not love, you know, those apes that Catherine keeps. Les singes enchaînés. Their little hands, their little necks fettered. My babies love me for myself." She's so small. Her bones are so delicate, her waist so narrow. If two law students make one cardinal, two Annes make one Catherine. Various women are sitting on low stools, sewing, or rather pretending to sew. One of them is Mary Boleyn. She keeps her head down, as well she might. One of them is Mary Shelton, a bold pink and white Boleyn cousin, who looks him over and, quite obviously, says to herself, "Mother of God, is that the best Lady Carey thought she could get?" Back in the shadows, there is another girl, who has her face turned away, trying to hide. He does not know who she is, but he understands why she's looking fixedly at the floor. Anne seems to inspire it. Now that he's put the dogs down, he's doing the same thing. "Alors," Anne says softly, "suddenly everything is about you. The king does not cease to quote Master Cremwell." She pronounces it as if she can't manage the English. Cremwell. "He is so right. He is at all points correct. Also, let us not forget, Maître Cremwell makes us laugh." "I see the king does sometimes laugh, but you, madame, in your situation as you find yourself..." A black glance over her shoulder. "I suppose I seldom laugh, if I think, but I had not thought. This is what your life has come to." Dusty fragments, dried leaves and stems have fallen down her skirts. She stares out at the morning. "Let me put it this way," he says. "Since my Lord Cardinal was reduced, how much progress have you seen in your cause?"
"None."
"No one knows the workings of Christian countries like my Lord Cardinal. No one is more intimate with kings. Think how bound to you he would be, Lady Anne, if you were the means of erasing these misunderstandings and restoring him to the king's grace." She doesn't answer. "Think," he says, "he is the only man in England who can obtain for you what you need."
"Very well. Make his case. You have 5 minutes.
Otherwise, I can see you're really busy." Anne looks at him with dislike and speaks in French.
"What do you know of how I occupy my hours?"
"My lady, are we having this conversation in English or French? Your choice entirely. But let's make it one or the other, yes?" He sees a movement from the corner of his eye. The half-hidden girl has raised her face. She is plain and pale. She looks shocked.
"You are indifferent," Anne says.
"Yes."
"Very well. In French."
He tells her again. "The cardinal is the only man who can deliver a good verdict from the Pope. He is the only man who can deliver the king's conscience and deliver it clean." She listens. He will say that for her. He's always wondered how well women can hear beneath the muffling folds of their veils and hoods, but Anne does give the impression that she is hearing what he has said. She waits him out, at least. She doesn't interrupt, until at last she does. "So," she says, "if the king wants it and the cardinal wants it, he who was formerly the chief subject in the kingdom, then I must say, Master Cremwell, it is all taking a marvellous long while to come to pass." From her corner, her sister adds, barely audible, "And she's not getting any younger." Not a stitch have the women added to their sewing since he has been in the room. "One may resume," he asks, persuading her. "There is a moment left." Oh, yes, Anne says, but a moment only. In Lent, I ration my patience.
He tells her to dismiss the slanderers who claim that the cardinal obstructed her cause. He tells her how it distresses the cardinal that the king should not have his heart's desire, which was ever the cardinal's desire too. He tells her how all the king's subjects repose their hopes in her for an heir to the throne, and how he is sure they are right to do so. He reminds her of the many gracious letters she's written to the cardinal in times past, all of which he has on file.
Very nice, she says, when he stops. Very nice, Master Cromwell, but try again. One thing, one simple thing we asked of the cardinal, and he would not. One simple thing.
You know it was not simple.
Perhaps I am a simple person, Anne says. Do you feel I am?
You may be. I hardly know you.
The reply incenses her. He sees her sister smirk. You may go, Anne says, and Mary jumps up and follows him out. Once again, Mary's cheeks are flushed, her lips are parted. She's brought her sewing with her, which he thinks is strange, but perhaps if she leaves it behind, Anne pulls the stitches out.
Out of breath again, Lady Carey.
We thought she might run up and slap you. Will you come again? Shelton and I can't wait.
She can stand it, he says. And Mary says, indeed, she likes a skirmish with someone on her own level.
What are you working there? He asks. As she shows him, it is Anne's new coat of arms.
On everything, I suppose, he says, and she smiles broadly. Oh, yes, her petticoats, her handkerchiefs, her coifs and her veils. She has garments that no one ever wore before, just so she can have her arms sewn on, not to mention the wall hangings, the table napkins.
And how are you? She looks down, glance swivelling away from him. Worn down. Frayed a little, you might say. Christmas was...
They quarrelled, so one hears.
First he quarrelled with Catherine, then he came here for sympathy. Anne said, what? I told you not to argue with Catherine. You know you always lose. If he were not a king, she says with relish, one could pity him for the dog's life they lead him.
There have been rumours that Anne...
Yes, but she's not. I will be the first to know. If she's thickened by an inch, it would be me who let out her clothes. Besides, she can't because they don't. They haven't.
She'd tell you.
Of course. Out of spite.
Still, Mary will not meet his eyes.
But she seems to feel she owes him information. When they are alone, she lets him unlace her bodice.
At least he doesn't call you to do it.
He pulls down her shift and kisses her breasts.
Good man if you can find them.
Mary laughs, a boisterous, unsisterly laugh. It must be audible within, because almost at once the door opens and the small hiding girl manoeuvres herself around it. Her face is grave, her reserve complete. Her skin is so fine that it is almost translucent. Lady Carey, she says, Lady Anne wants you. She speaks their names as if she's making introductions between two cockroaches. Mary snaps, oh, by the saints, and turns on her heel, whipping her train behind her with the ease of long practice. To his surprise, the small pale girl catches his glance. Behind the retreating back of Mary Boleyn, she raises her own eyes to heaven. Walking away, eight antechambers back to the rest of his day, he knows that Anne has stepped forward to a place where he can see her, the morning light lying along the curve of her throat. He sees the thin arch of her eyebrow, her smile, the turn of her head on her long, slender neck. He sees her speed, intelligence and rigour. He didn't think she would help the cardinal, but what do you lose by asking? He thinks, it is the first proposition I have put to her, probably not the last. There was a moment when Anne gave him all her attention, a skewering dark glance. The king, too, knows how to look. Blue eyes, their mildness deceptive. Is this how they look at each other, or in some other way? For a second he understands it, then he doesn't. He stands by a window. A flock of starlings settles among the tight black buds of a bare tree. Then, like black buds unfolding, they open their wings. They flutter and sing, stirring everything into motion, air, wings, black notes in music. He becomes aware that he is watching them with pleasure. That something almost extinct, some small gesture towards the future, is ready to welcome the spring. In some spare, desperate way, he's looking forward to Easter, the end of Lenten fasting, the end of penitence. There is a world beyond this black world. There is a world of the possible. A world where Anne can be queen is a world where Cromwell can be Cromwell. He sees it, then he doesn't. The moment is fleeting, but insight cannot be taken back. You cannot return to the moment you were in before. In Lent, there are butchers who will sell you red meat if you know where to go. At Austin Friars, he goes down to talk to his kitchen staff and says to his chief man, "The cardinal is sick. He is dispensed from Lent." His cook takes off his hat. "By the Pope?" "By me." He runs his eye along the row of knives in their racks, the cleavers for splitting bones. He picks one up, looks at its edge, decides it needs sharpening, and says, "Do you think I look like a murderer, in your good opinion?" A silence. After a while, Thurston proffers, "At this moment, Master, I would have to say, no, but suppose I were making my way to Gray's Inn. Can you picture to yourself, carrying a folio of papers and an inkhorn? I do suppose a clerk would be carrying those, so you can't picture it." Thurston takes off his hat again and turns it inside out. He looks at it as if his brains might be inside it, or at least some prompt as to what to say next. "I see how you would look like a lawyer. Not like a murderer, no. But if you will forgive me, Master, you always look like a man who knows how to cut up a carcass." He has the kitchen make beef olives for the cardinal, stuffed with sage and marjoram, neatly trussed and placed side by side in trays, so that the cooks at Richmond need to do nothing but bake them. "Show me where it says in the Bible, a man shall not eat beef olives in March." He thinks of Lady Anne, her unslaked appetite for a fight, the sad ladies about her. He sends those ladies some flat baskets of small tarts, made of preserved oranges and honey. To Anne herself, he sends a dish of almond cream. It is flavoured with rose water and decorated with the preserved petals of roses and with candied violets. He is above riding across the country, carrying food himself, but not that much above it. It's not so many years since the Frescobaldi kitchen in Florence, or perhaps it is, but his memory is clear, exact. He was clarifying calf's foot jelly, chatting away in his mixture of French, Tuscan and Putney, when someone shouted, "Tommaso, they want you upstairs." His movements were unhurried, as he nodded to a kitchen child, who brought him a basin of water. He washed his hands, dried them on a linen cloth. He took off his apron and hung it on a peg. For all he knows, it is there still. He saw a young boy, younger than him, on hands and knees, scrubbing the steps. He sang as he worked. "Scaramella va alla guerra, con la lancia e la rotella. La zombero, bora borambetta, la bora borombo." "If you please, Giacomo," he said. To let him pass, the boy moved aside into the curve of the wall. A shift of the light wiped the curiosity from his face, blanking it, fading his past into the past, washing the future clean. Scaramella is off to war. But I've been to war, he thought. He had gone upstairs. In his ears, the roll and stutter of the song's military drum. He had gone upstairs and never come down again. In a corner of the Frescobaldi counting house, a table was waiting for him. Scaramella fa la gala, he hummed. He had taken his place, sharpened a quill. His thoughts bubbled and swirled, Tuscan, Putney, Castilian oaths. But when he committed his thoughts to paper, they came out in Latin and perfectly smooth. Even before he walks in from the kitchens at Austin Friars, the women of the house know that he has been to see Anne. So, Joanne demands, tall or short?
Neither.
I heard she was very tall. Sallow, is she not?
Yes, sallow.
They say she is graceful, dances well. We did not dance. Mercy says, but what do you think, a friend to the gospel?
He shrugs. We did not pray. Alice, his little niece.
What was she wearing?
Ah, I can tell you that. He prices and sources her, hood to hem, foot to fingertip.
For her headdress, Anne affects the French style, the round hood flattering the fine bones of her face. He explains this, and though his tone is cool, mercantile, the women somehow do not appreciate it. You don't like her, do you? Alice says. And he says it's not for him to have an opinion, or you either, Alice, he says, hugging her and making her giggle. The child, Joe, says, our master is in a good mood. This squirrel trim, Mercy says. And he says, Calabrian. Alice says, oh, Calabrian, and wrinkles her nose. Joanne remarks, I must say, Thomas, it seems you got close.
Are her teeth good?
Mercy says.
For God's sake, woman, when she sinks them into me, I'll let you know.
When the Cardinal had heard that the Duke of Norfolk was coming out to Richmond to tear him with his teeth, he had laughed and said, Marry Thomas, time to be going. But to go north, the Cardinal needs funding. The problem is put to the King's Council, who fall out and continue the quarrel in his hearing. After all, Charles Brandon says, one can't let an archbishop creep away to his enthronement like a servant who's stolen the spoons. He's done more than steal the spoons, Norfolk says. He's eaten the dinner that would have fed all England. He's filched the tablecloth, by God, and drunk the cellar dry. The king can be elusive. One day, when he thinks he has an appointment to meet Henry, he gets Master Secretary instead. Sit down, Gardiner says. Sit down and listen to me. Contain yourself in patience while I put you straight on a few matters. He watches him ranging to and fro, Stephen the noonday devil. Gardiner is a man with bones loose-jointed, his lines flowing with menace. He has great hairy hands and knuckles which crack when he folds his right fist into his left palm. He takes away the menace conveyed and the message. Pausing in the doorway, he says mildly, Your cousin sends greetings. Gardiner stares at him. His eyebrows bristle like a dog's hackles. He thinks that Cromwell presumes... Not the king, he says soothingly. Not his majesty. I mean your cousin, Richard Williams. Aghast, Gardiner says. That old tale. Oh, come, he says. It's no disgrace to be a royal bastard. Or so we think in my family. In your family? What grasp have they on propriety? I have no interest in this young person, recognise no kinship with him, and I will do nothing for him. Truly, you don't need to. He calls himself Richard Cromwell now. As he is going, really going this time, he adds, Don't let it keep you awake, Stephen. I've been into the matter. You may be related to Richard, but you are not related to me.
He smiles. Inside, he's beside himself with rage, running with it, as if his blood were thin and full of dilute venom like the uncoloured blood of a snake. As soon as he gets home to Austin Friars, he hugs Rafe Sadler and makes his hair stand up in spikes. Heaven direct me, boy or hedgehog. Rafe, Richard, I am feeling penitent. It is the season, Rafe says. I want, he says, to become perfectly calm. I want to be able to get into the coop without ruffling the chicken's feathers. I want to be less like Uncle Norfolk and more like Marlin Spike. He has a long, soothing talk in Welsh with Richard, who laughs at him because old words are fading from his memory and he's forever sliding through bits of English with a sly Borderlands intonation. He gives his little nieces the pearl and coral bracelets he bought them weeks ago, but forgot to give. He goes down to the kitchen and makes suggestions, all of them cheerful. He calls his household staff together, his clerks. We need to plan it, he says, how the cardinal will be made comfortable on the road north. He wants to go slowly so the people can admire him. He needs to arrive in Peterborough for Holy Week, and from there shift by stages to Southwell, where he will plan his further progress to York. The Archbishop's palace at Southwell has good rooms, but still we may need to get builders in. George Cavendish has told him that the Cardinal has taken to spending time in prayer. There are some monks at Richmond whose company he has sought. They spell out to him the value of thorns in the flesh and salt in the wound, the merits of bread and water, and the sombre delights of self-flagellation. Oh, that settles it, he says, annoyed. We have to get him on the road. He'd be better off in Yorkshire. He says to Norfolk, Well, my lord, how shall we do this? Do you want him gone or not? Yes? Then come to the king with me. Norfolk grunts. Messengers are sent. A day or so later, they find themselves together in an antechamber. They wait. Norfolk paces. Oh, by St. Jude, the Duke says. Shall we get some fresh air? Or don't you lawyers need it? They stroll in the gardens, or he strolls, the Duke stamps. When do the flowers come out? The Duke says. When I was a boy, we never had flowers. It was Buckingham, you know, who brought in this not garden sort of stuff. Oh, dear, it was fancy. The Duke of Buckingham, King Gardener, had his head cut off for treason. That was 1521, less than 10 years ago. It seems sad to mention it now, in the presence of the spring, singing from every bush, every bough. A summons is received. As they proceed to their interview, the Duke balks and jibs. His eye rolls and his nostrils distend. His breath comes short. When the Duke lays a hand on his shoulder, he's forced to slow his pace and they scuffle along, he resisting his impulse to pull away, like two war veterans in a beggar's procession. Scaramella va alla guerra. Norfolk's hand is trembling. But it is only when they get into the presence that he fully understands how it rattles the old Duke to be in a room with Henry Tudor. The gilded ebullience makes him shrink inside his clothes. Henry greets them cordially. He says it is a wonderful day and pretty much a wonderful world. He spins around the room, arms wide, reciting some verses of his own composition. He will talk about anything except the cardinal. Frustrated, Norfolk turns a dusky red and begins to mutter. Dismissed, they are backing out. Henry calls, Oh, Cromwell! He and the Duke exchange glances. By the mass, mutters the Duke. Hand behind his back, he indicates, Begone, my Lord Norfolk. I'll catch up with you later. Henry stands with arms folded, eyes on the ground. He says nothing till he, Cromwell, has come close. £1,000? Henry whispers. It is on the tip of his tongue to say, That will be a start on the 10,000 which, to the best of my knowledge and belief, you have owed the Cardinal of York for a decade now. He doesn't say it, of course. At such moments, Henry expects you to fall to your knees, Duke, Earl, Commoner, light and heavy, old and young. He does it. Scar tissue pulls. Few of us, by our 40s, are not carrying injuries. The King signals you can get up. He adds, his tone curious, "The Duke of Norfolk shows you many marks of friendship and favour." The hand on the shoulder, he means the minute and unexpected vibration of ducal palm against plebeian muscle and bone. The Duke is careful to preserve all distinctions of rank. Henry seems relieved. An unwelcome thought creeps into his head. What if you, Henry Tudor, were to be taken ill and fall at my feet? Am I allowed to pick you up? Or must I send for an earl to do it, or a bishop? Henry walks away. He turns and says in a small voice, "Every day I miss the Cardinal of York." There is a pause. He whispers, "Take the money with our blessing. Don't tell the Duke. Don't tell anyone. Ask your master to pray for me. Tell him it is the best I can do." The thanks he makes, still from his kneeling situation, is eloquent and extensive. Henry looks at him bleakly and says, "Dear God, Master Cromwell, you can talk, can't you?" He goes out, face composed, fighting the impulse to smile broadly. Scaramella falagala. "Every day I miss the Cardinal of York." Norfolk says, What did he say?" "Oh, nothing," he says. "Just some special hard words he wants me to convey to the Cardinal." The itinerary is drawn up. The Cardinal's effects are put on coastal barges to be taken to Hull and go overland from there. He himself has beaten the barges down to a reasonable rate. He tells Richard, "You know, £1,000 isn't much when you have a Cardinal to move." Richard asks, "How much of your own money is sunk in this enterprise?" "Some debts should never be tallied," he says. I know what is owed me, but by God, I know what I owe." To Cavendish, he says, "How many servants is he taking?"
"Only 160.
"Only?" He nods. "Right. Hendon, Royston, Huntingdon, Peterborough. He has men riding ahead with precise instructions." That last night, Wolsey gives him a package. Inside it is a small and hard object, a seal or ring.
"Open it when I'm gone."
People keep walking in and out of the Cardinal's private chamber, carrying chests and bundles of papers. Cavendish wanders through, holding a silver monstrance.
"You will come north," the Cardinal says.
"I'll come to fetch you the minute the King summons you back." He believes and does not believe that this will happen. The Cardinal gets to his feet. There is a constraint in the air. He, Cromwell, kneels for a blessing. The Cardinal holds out a hand to be kissed. His turquoise ring is missing. The fact does not evade him. For a moment the Cardinal's hand rests on his shoulder, fingers spread, thumb in the hollow of his collarbone. It is time he was gone. So much has been said between them that it is needless to add a marginal note. It is not for him now to gloss the text of their dealings, nor append a moral. This is not the occasion to embrace. If the Cardinal has no more eloquence to offer, he surely has none. Before he has reached the door of the room, the Cardinal has turned back to the fireplace. He pulls his chair to the blaze and raises a hand to shield his face. But his hand is not between himself and the fire. It is between himself and the closing door. He makes for the courtyard. He falters in a smoky recess where the light has extinguished itself. He leans against the wall. He is crying. He says to himself,
Let George Cavendish not come by and see me, and write it down and make it into a play. He swears softly, in many languages, at life, at himself for giving way to its demands. Servants walk past, saying, "Master Cromwell's horse is here for him. Master Cromwell's escort at the gate." He waits till he is in command of himself and exits, dispersing coins. When he gets home, the servants ask him, "Are we to paint out the cardinal's coat of arms?" "No, by God," he says. "On the contrary, repaint it." He stands back for a look. "The chuffs could look more lively. And we need a better scarlet for the hat." He hardly sleeps. He dreams of Liz. He wonders if she would know him. The man he vows that soon he will be. Adamant, mild, a keeper of the king's peace. Towards dawn, he dozes. He wakes up thinking, "The cardinal just now will be mounting his horse. Why am I not with him?" It is the 5th of April. Joanne meets him on the stairs. Chastely she kisses his cheek. "Why does God test us?" she whispers. He murmurs, "I do not feel we will pass." He says, "Perhaps I should go up to Southwell myself." "I'll go for you," Rafe says. He gives him a list. "Have the whole of the Archbishop's palace scrubbed out. My lord will be bringing his own bed. Draft in kitchen staff from the King's Arms. Check the stabling. Get in musicians. Last time I passed through, I noticed some pigsties up against the palace wall. Find out the owner, pay him off, and knock them down. Don't drink in the Crown. The ale is worse than my father's." Richard says, "Sir, it is time to let the cardinal go." "This is a tactical retreat, not a rout." They think he's gone, but he's only gone into a back room. He skulks among the files. He hears Richard say, "His heart is leading him." It is an experienced heart. But can a general organize a retreat when he doesn't know where the enemy is? The king is so double in this matter.
"One could retreat straight into his arms."
"Jesus, you think our master is double too?"
"Triple at least," Rafe says.
"Look, there was no profit for him, ever, in deserting the old man. What would he get but the name of deserter? Perhaps something is to be got by sticking fast, for all of us." "Off you go then, swine boy. Who else would think about the pigsties? Thomas More, for instance, would never think about them."
"Or he would be exhorting the pig-keeper, my good man. Easter approacheth. Hast thou prepared to receive Holy Communion?"
Rafe laughs.
"By the way, Richard, hast thou?"
Richard says,
"I can get a piece of bread any day in the week."
During Holy Week, reports come in from Peterborough. More people have crowded in to look at Wolsey than have been in that town in living memory. As the cardinal moves north, he follows him on the map of these islands he keeps in his head: Stamford, Grantham, Newark. The travelling court arrives in Southwell on the 28th of April. He, Cromwell, writes to soothe him. He writes to warn him. He is afraid that the Boleyns, or Norfolk, or both, have found some way of implanting a spy in the cardinal's retinue. The ambassador, Chapuis, hurrying away from an audience with the king, has touched his sleeve, drawn him aside.
"Monsieur Cromwell, I thought to call at your house. We are neighbours, you know."
"I should like to welcome you."
"But people inform me you are often with the king now, which is pleasant, is it not? Your old master, I hear from him every week. He has become solicitous about the queen's health. He asks if she is in good spirits and begs her to consider that soon she will be restored to the king's bosom and bed."
Chapuis smiles. He is enjoying himself.
"The concubine will not help him.
We know you have tried with her and failed. So now he turns back to the queen. He is forced to ask.
And the queen says...
She says, I hope God in his mercy finds it possible to forgive the cardinal, for I never can.
Chapuis waits. He does not speak. The ambassador resumes.
I think you are sensible of the tangle of wreckage that will be left if this divorce is granted, or, shall we say, somehow extorted from his holiness. The emperor, in defense of his aunt, may make war on England. Your merchant friends will lose their livelihoods, and many will lose their lives. Your Tudor king may go down, and the old nobility come into their own.
Why are you telling me this?
I am telling all Englishmen.
Door to door. He is meant to pass to the cardinal this message, that he has come to the end of his credit with the emperor. What will that do but drive him into an appeal to the French king? Either way, treason lies. He imagines the cardinal among the canons at Southwell, in his chair in the chapter house, presiding beneath the high vaulting like a prince at his ease in some forest glade, wreathed by carvings of leaves and flowers. They are so supple that it is as if the columns, the ribs, have quickened, as if stone has burst into florid life. The capitals are decked with berries, finials are twisted stems, roses entangle the shafts, flowers and seeds flourish on one stalk. From the foliage, faces peer, the faces of dogs, of hares, of goats. There are human faces too, so lifelike that perhaps they can change their expression. Perhaps they stare down, astonished at the portly scarlet form of his patron, and perhaps in the silence of the night, when the cannons are sleeping, the stone men whistle and sing. In Italy he learned a memory system, and furnished it with pictures. Some are drawn from wood and field, from hedgerow and copse, shy, hiding animals, eyes bright in the undergrowth. Some are foxes and deer. Some are griffins, dragons. Some are men and women, nuns, warriors, doctors of the church. In their hands he puts unlikely objects. St. Ursula, a crossbow. St. Jerome, a scythe. While Plato bears a soup ladle, and Achilles a dozen damsons in a wooden bowl. It is no use hoping to remember with the help of common objects familiar faces. One needs startling juxtapositions, images that are more or less peculiar, ridiculous, even indecent. When you have made the images, you place them about the world in locations you choose, each one with its parcel of words, of figures, which they will yield you on demand. At Greenwich, a shaven cat may peep at you from behind a cupboard. At the Palace of Westminster, a snake may leer down from a beam and hiss your name. Some of these images are flat, and you can walk on them. Some are clothed in skin and walk around in a room. But perhaps they are men with their heads on backwards, or with tufted tails like the leopards in coats of arms. Some scowl at you like Norfolk, or gawp at you like my Lord Suffolk, with bewilderment. Some speak, some quack. He keeps them in strict order in the gallery of his mind's eye. Perhaps it is because he is used to making these images that his head is peopled with the cast of 1,000 plays, 10,000 interludes. It is because of this practice that he tends to glimpse his dead wife lurking in a stairwell, her white face upturned, or whisking around a corner of the Austin Friars, or the house at Stepney. Now the image is beginning to merge with that of her sister Joanne, and everything that belonged to Liz is beginning to belong to her, her half-smile, her questioning glance, her way of being naked, till he says, enough, and scrubs her out of his mind. Rafe rides up the country with messages to Wolsey, too secret to put into letters. He would go himself, but though Parliament is prorogued, he cannot get away.
because he is afraid of what might be said about Wolsey if he's not there to defend him. And at short notice the king might want him, or Lady Anne. And although I am not with you in person, he writes, yet be assured I am, and during my life shall be, with your grace in heart, spirit, prayer, and service. The cardinal replies, he is mine own good, trusty, and most assured refuge in this my calamity. He is mine own entirely beloved Cromwell. He writes to ask for quails. He writes to ask for flower seeds. Seeds? Joanne says. He is planning to take root.
This ends Disc 7.